My name's Terry Thornton, and it's my pleasure. I'm curator of education here at the Modern. It's my pleasure to welcome you to Tuesday evenings at the Modern. This is an ongoing lecture series. It runs for 10 weeks this fall and will begin again in the spring this fall. It runs through November 15th. With the exception of next week, when we'll be off, there was a scheduling conflict, so I hope that hiccup does not get in the way of this good attendance. Please come back on the 27th when Gretchen Diebenkorn Grant will be here. She is, you might guess, the daughter of Richard Diebenkorn. So this is in conjunction with Diebenkorn, the Ocean Park series, which opens on the 24th. So you'll get to hear her perspective as Diebenkorn's daughter as she grew up with him and the art he made. So I hope you'll be here for that. I would also like to thank the Arts Council of Fort Worth and Tarrant County for their support of the Tuesday evening lecture series. We're happy to still be able to make these free and available to the public. I hope you appreciate that, and that if you haven't already, you could fill out a survey for us so that we kind of have a better idea of who our audience is. Tonight, artist, writer, and curator Alejandro Cesarco is here to present his work and ideas as found in each of these practices. Alejandro now lives and works in New York, where he has been since receiving his MA in studio art from the NYU's International Center for Photography. But he is originally from Montevideo, Uruguay, and is representing Uruguay in the current 54th Venice Biennale. It is in the Uruguay Pavilion that I encountered Alejandro's video methodology and his piece titled The Gift and the Retribution. The pavilion was a destination for me after having read about Alejandro's work. I knew I wanted to extend tonight's invitation when I realized that Alejandro was the artist who had made the very funny but profound colored pencil drawings that repeated the phrase, "When I am happy, I won't have to make these anymore." I know, you gotta love him, right? In the show at Art Pace in San Antonio last year. And also when I learned that he was the mastermind / director of the nonprofit arts organization Art Resources Transfer, where he initiated and edits Between Artists, an ongoing series of conversation-based books that are nothing short of awesome in their concept and their content. Therefore, seeing methodology and the gift and the retribution just confirmed my resolve to get him here so we could learn more about him and his work this evening. Alejandro also made an impression at Art Basel this year, where his work was chosen for a solo booth in Art Statements and was awarded one of the two art prizes, which includes an acquisition donated, in Alejandro's case, to the Museum of Modern Art in Vienna. And it puts him in outstanding company. I invite you to visit that site and see some of the other artists who have won that prize. He has also been recognized with fellowships and grants, including the 2009 Arts Matters Grant or Fellowship Grant, the 2008 Rolex Mentor and Protege Arts Initiative Award, for which he was selected by John Baldessari, and the 2003 Emerging Artist Fellowship from Socrates Sculpture Park. Other solo exhibitions in recent years have included One Without the Other at the Museo Rufino Tamayo in 2011, Present Memory at Tate Modern in 2010, two films at Murray Guy in New York in 2009, three works at Tanya Leighton in Berlin in 2009, and Retrospective, which was in collaboration with John Baldessari at Murray Guy in 2007. In addition, Alejandro has curated some impressive and, like in his own work, carefully considered and conceived exhibitions in the U.S., Uruguay, and Argentina. It is with great anticipation and pleasure that I present Alejandro Cesarco, so please join me in welcoming to Tuesday Evenings at the Modern.
Hi, good evening. Thanks for being here, and thank you, Terry, for the very generous introduction. and for inviting me to be here. I'm going to start by reading a short text that introduces and prefaces and outlines some of the key concepts and ideas that generally run through my work. And while I do that, I'd like to screen a film. The mic is not working. I should perhaps preface the preface by mentioning that I've recently been thinking about Jorge Luis Borges pretty seriously again. And I think you'll notice that Borges will appear again and again, credited and uncredited, throughout my presentation, as his words, books, and concepts have heavily influenced my thoughts and methodologies. I think that Borges, above all else, was an extraordinary reader, and perhaps that has been his mark and his influence. As you know, he was literally a myopic reader, one who needs to read things up close, who glues his eyes to the page. And I think this emphasis on the importance of reading closely, of necessarily slowing down, has permeated as a specific tone and tempo into most of the work I've produced so far. The essence of Borges, at least for me, is his idea that the framing, which is to say the context and the reader's own expectation of the text, are what ultimately constitute the text itself. And I'm curious about this idea both because it hints at defining a set of responsibilities for the reader, or in this case, the viewer, and because I think that at the core of these responsibilities is the definition of reading as a creative or generative act. I'm very interested in this, in continuing to address the act of artistic production as a practice of reading. And by reading, I mean to include, on the one hand, the network of relationships that every text proposes, and on the other hand, to understand how meaning is possible and by what means. I'm referring both to the conditions that make possible the text and the consequences or effects that this text produces. I'm also interested in amplifying this concept of reading in a way that may also include the idea of reading as a libidinal or erotic act, that is, an activity associated with the generation of pleasure. Consequently, all this brings me to the idea of translation, which seems to be a perfect metaphor for the possibility of reading as writing, the possibility of engaging closely and intimately with a text. The idea of translation and the notion of narrative, more precisely the notion of a narrative translated, is in fact a recurrent motif in my work. I actually often consider my work as a series of unfaithful subtitles, subtitles that move too slow or that actually don't fully understand the language they are translating, or they get distracted and start telling other stories, making different connections, etc. In general, I tend to catalog, classify, appropriate, read, misread, and retell. My work often takes an existing text, what I call a pretext, and retells it as a way of transforming discursive practice through repetition. I believe, of course, that difference is created in these acts of repetition, in these creative infidelities towards a previous text. And it is perhaps these differences, these infidelities towards a source text, that constitute the distinction between to repeat and to reduplicate. I ultimately think that the function of repetition in my work signals not necessarily a desire to return, but a need to call attention to look at something again and to look at it differently, from a different place at a different angle. And perhaps, in a way, that is all that art is, a gesture towards a point of observation for other people to notice. This, for me, connects or brings to mind another of Borges's ideas, which is the concept that each writer, through their work, always creates his own precursors. This is another way of saying that through the reworking of the past, each new work inevitably changes not only, and hopefully, our conception of the future, but our conception of the past. This provides an interesting framework through which to look and analyze our relation to the past, how the past is written and articulated, how the past enables and determines our possibilities as producers. And as I was just saying, how we rewrite the past with our own work. I think that if we were to take this idea to its logical extreme, what it ultimately proposes is the possibility of thinking about art as a form of art history. There's a nice quote by Adorno, Theodor Adorno, that somehow summarizes all this. It says, "Art wills what has never existed so far, but at the same time, all art is one big déjà vu, for the past looms over everything." I think you'll be able to see once I start showing some of my work how these perhaps rather abstract ideas have become the foundation or the structure from which I construct my practice. I'm interested in how meaning is displaced and how discursive circumstances are recontextualized through memory, recognition, and the natural opacity of language. I'm drawn to fragmentary, marginal, or minor forms like lists, indices, diaries, notebooks, and letters. It's the concreteness of these forms and the clarity of their address that appeals to me. And in this regard, I'm reminded of Virginia Woolf's dictum about writing that I think can easily be extrapolated to the visual arts. She says, "To know whom to write for is to know how to write." Working, in many ways, is a form of embrace, a form of being embraced, in the sense that every idea is an idea reaching out. I tend to think that with the created object or situation, an artist is trying to work his or her way out of a previously known territory and attempting to push the audience into the unknown. The strategies of address or of communication employed by the artist are orchestrated to achieve this crossing of the border. The consequence of a work of art is ultimately to return its viewers to himself or herself changed. Or to say it in a different way, the aim is to problematize the meanings we automatically confer or assume, and thus to unwrite the world as it is written by prior discursive practices. For me, the strategic emphasis in producing the work is not necessarily or not primarily placed on the transmission of information, but rather on how meaning is felt. Clarice Lispector, a Brazilian author whom I also read repeatedly, would say, "Thinking is an act, but feeling is a fact." Before one thinks or conceptualizes, there is an element of response that is prior to any decision. I think it is at this point that the work engages the viewer. A work of art is a strategy of seduction, a way of deviating someone from their truth. All this is not to say that I'm not interested in the ideas or questions that the work proposes. In fact, what interests me most is not so much what is seen, but what is understood. But I think understanding comes afterwards, it comes later. And this later is a stage or a moment that may actually never arrive, and it is okay that it be this way. I'm interested in stretching or prolonging as much as possible the moment of experiencing the work and the moment in which it is apprehended. By this I mean that I intend my work to never completely resolve itself. I'm interested that it remain asking questions, resulting in new works and new possibilities. So with this, perhaps we can now start to look at some recent projects and start to untangle more concretely some of my ideas. One second. This video that was looping as I was talking is called Present Memory, and it was commissioned by Tate Modern and exhibited there last summer. It's a portrait of my dad sometime after he had been diagnosed with lung cancer. And he passed away last November. It was filmed on 16mm, and this film was developed and then projected onto the same space where it had been recorded. And that projection was in turn documented using video, and hence creating this doubling or ghost-like quality. The work is very literally a projection of fears and anxieties, a form of rehearsing a future mourning or loss. Ironically, though, this work perhaps represents a break, or at least it is different from what I was referring to in my introduction, by which I mean to say that the work does not necessarily illustrate the program I was trying to outline. But I was interested in showing it in relation to the introduction and in terms in relation to the function of portraiture and the inevitably unstable nature of portraiture. What I mean is that even though the statements I had just read attempted to define or outline or somehow portray my work, they're not ever rigid or stable. They're constantly shifting. So in a way, what I'm trying to say is that I'm ultimately not very interested in acquiring a style or a defined style. This is an installation view of a work called Index from 2000. And there are pages that go from A to Z of an index of a book that I haven't yet written and most probably never will. I think of it as a container or a structure that's become its own content. This particular index, I've since gone on to make others, was in a way an attempt to produce a book that would include all books, a sort of library in a book or a meta book. And in this sense, the index is halfway biographical and halfway theory text. It is at the same time extremely personal, at times hermetic, yet full of cliches. The work is printed on photographic paper, somehow acknowledging the inherently indexical quality of photography, its ability to record that which has been and that its referent is always outside itself, but also photography's ability to construct an archive or preserve memory. And this is a detail from that index. All of the index have somewhat obsessive structure in the sense that I try to imagine what would happen on certain pages and think of what would happen if Walter Benjamin shared the page with my grandfather. What would that page be about? This is part of an ongoing series of drawings that translate a rather stubborn belief that someday things will change and happiness will occur. The drawings have a somewhat therapeutic dimension, a way of making productive a certain anxiety or discomfort, but they're clearly a little bit tongue-in-cheek. I haven't made this in a while, which I guess is good. This is an installation view of a piece called Margarit Duras' India Song, and it's a two-screen video installation with sculptural elements. The installation includes two large walls that are used as screens against a deep red, like a royal painted background. In the room, there are also three very slowly rotating fans as if to indicate that something's about to happen, and a text by an Argentinian writer and critic called Daniel Link that is given as a handout in both English and Spanish and tells of the experience of watching either this installation or the original film. Margarit Duras wrote a play called India Song in the mid-70s and later adapted it into a film which she directed. Duras actually took like a 10-year break from writing fiction and dedicated herself to cinema, or producing cinema against cinema, or deconstructing cinema. My project presents India Song as an appropriated text that is retold and allowed to perform very differently. The love story of the play is retold by a voiceover that primarily tells the narrative structure of how this love story is told. And this is done 4 times in different ways. The video shows establishing shots of the inside and outside of the French embassy in Calcutta, taken from Duras's films. There's also a peculiar anecdote in relation to this, in the sense that the film was actually shot in the outskirts of Paris in a decaying mansion that was made to look like a residency in India. But in that way, setting up this very complex relationship between colonialism and translation. And as you've noticed, the two video screens work with similar images found in the film that are off by perspective or time sequence, highlighting the work's own repetitive methodology and structure. This is one of 10 prints that present 10 different translations of Dante's first canto, the Divine Comedy, each titled after a chapter in Italo Calvino's novel, If on a Winter's Night a Traveler. It's a reflection on the construction of narrative, the complicity between reading and writing, translation practices, and the impossibility of a faithful reproduction. The translations span over 100 years, so they reveal the historical differences in languages and interpretation, in each constituting practically a new text, with slight independence from the original. This is a book I published to coincide with an exhibition where I was showing the Dante Calvino pieces, and it's the first ever English translation of Uruguayan poet Idea Vilariño's book Poemas de Amor from 1957, and you'll see this work reappear later on. And it's a form of appropriation that investigates the potential of literal translation as a visual act. This is a page from the book. In thinking about this work, I often consider it as an emotional ready-made, by which I mean an emotional experience that is realized or mediated through the repetition of someone else's. This is an installation view of Retrospective, a collaborative project I did with John Baldessari that addressed the idea of looking back as a framing device and as a narrative mode. Implicit in the project was a concern for the difference created by retelling and representing the past and the present, which sets up questions such as who narrates and for whom, what is included and what is left out of this narrative. And this, of course, parallels John's formal strategy of concealing information as a way of redirecting our vision and questioning what constitutes a whole, what constitutes a part, etc. The works are 12 silk screens on aluminium, each representing a page from a book in which all the text is cancelled out except for the footnotes, which are what carries the narrative forward. Later, John responded to this, adding a second layer footnote or a title in opposite color to the one I had used to initially cancel the text. That's one of the pages, and that's a detail of it. The project also had somewhat to do with this idea of asking John to think about what it means to have 40 years of a career behind you and what liberties or responsibilities that entails, and how you think about your own place within history and how you participate in the creating of that history. And of course, John responded in this very distant, cynical way, and almost like, not laughing at my question, but clearly positioning himself within that. This is called The Ramones, an autobiography, and it's a song list organized in chronological order of every Ramones song that begins with the pronoun I. It's very profound. Again, an index work. The indices are, as I said, an ongoing project that somehow map the development of my interests and preoccupations And in this way, they've become a form of self-portraiture that unfolds over time. This particular one is called Index of Reading, and it's the most recent one I've made. I'm actually kind of finishing a fourth one that has to do, well, it's in the process of being developed. But this one self-consciously addresses the idea of what constitutes an index, dealing with, among other things, what its relation to reading, writing, memory, history, and forgetting. Another page. And the detail. This work is called Fade Out, and it's a single slide of a young woman that is projected continuously until her image fades out, which is a physical effect produced by the light and heat emanating from the projector. I call this work an exercise in forgetting. And the duration of this performance, as with the persistence of our memories, is undetermined. This is a piece, or part of a piece, called Flowers, and it presents the documentation of an act or performance for a public of one. I sent a bouquet of flowers to a selected group of women artists whose work I was interested in or looking at the moment. And the flowers were accompanied by a card with a text that read, "This sculpture by Alejandro Cesarco." Well, you can read it here. The artists I sent flowers to were Via Selmans, Elizabeth Payton, Ronnie Horn, Yvonne Rayner, Lynn Tillman, Louise Lawler, Yoko Ono, Rachel Harrison, Andrea Fraser, Sherry Levine. And probably, if I were to do this again today, the list would be quite different. This is an installation view. So the receipts are presented as documentation of the performance, again echoing tropes of first generation or historic conceptualism, but from a somewhat more self-consciously romantic perspective. The piece is ultimately an acknowledgement of debt, or a way of nodding to friends or admired influences, but it's also a way of defining an audience, becoming, in a way, a sort of compilation of affection. This is an optimistic wall drawing called Here Comes the Sun. Again, dealing with cliches of hope and of happiness to come. I'm really interested in this, using these very restrained economical means that create a complete staging and allow us to think about what I was referring to earlier as how meaning is felt. This, which you can barely see, is the cover of a book called Dedications that brings together all the dedications from my library at the time of publication. It's a compilation of the author's affections for their muses, mentors, and motivators. And to me, and this perhaps could be regarded as overly simplistic or naive, but to me, art is in many ways ultimately a way of getting someone to like us more. So this book compiles different justifications for producing work. These are covers of the series of books that Terry was referring to. And they're conversation-based books that I edit and publish. And it's, in a way of creating an archive of a particular slice of contemporary practice, somehow creating a parallel oral history of art. Usually the way these work is I approach an artist I'm interested in, and they select who they want to have a conversation with, and in that way somehow delegating curatorial responsibility in a way of attempting not to have the series be a total reflection of my interests, but allowing outside influence as well. Apart from these, I've published conversations between Nicola Juanini and John Kelsey, Harold Fletcher and Michael Rakowitz, and most recently John Baldessari and Barbara Bloom. Sorry. These are stills from a film called Everness. And it's, again, a 16-millimeter film that's transferred to digital, made up of five chapters. A remake of the very last scene of James Joyce's The Dead. A monologue on the meaning of tragedy. A breakfast scene and two songs, one from the Spanish Civil War and another from Brazil's Tropicalista movement. The work speaks of a first love and a loss of innocence and relates these notions to notions of classic literary tragedy. The work primarily centers around what I call an emotionally handicapped couple at the moment when their inability to access their own passions is articulated through language. This is a still from a film called Zeve Isaac, which means Grandfather Isaac in Yiddish. It's also a 16-millimeter film transfer to digital, in which my grandfather, by way of a script I wrote based on his personal story, he's a Holocaust survivor, explicitly addresses the possibilities, limitations, and responsibility of testimony, addressing questions such as what does it mean to testify, from where does one testify, or and to whom. The layering of narrative voices and the passage of time between the event and its retelling from first-hand experience to third generation is allegorically implied in my grandfather's passage from witness to actor. These are from a series of photographs printed on newspaper-type stock. The series is titled the title appears as that small caption below the image. The series is called Fragile Images That Keep Producing Death While Attempting to Preserve Life. Flowers Found in Crime Scenes, and they're numbered 1-4. They're part of a larger installation dealing with the genre conventions and history of the detective novel. The installation is titled The Streets Were Dark with Something More Than Night, or The Closer I Get to the End, the More I Rewrite the Beginning. I'll show now 2 or 3 minutes of the principal component of the installation.
The difference between genre and style. A loud knock on the door. The sunlight is thick as syrup in the quiet streets of the city. A letter arrives. A letter is talked about but never shown. There are words that are criminal, and there are others that judge them. Entangled in a web of lies, twice he looked at his watch. A couple hurried in through the entrance. Inside, the whiff of discreet adultery. A hotel room, an unmade bed. The evening got going very quickly. His eyes were shining as though he were on the verge of tears. the desperate attempt to reconstruct the story, the inevitable urge to decipher a possible chain of events, a rational causality, a relationship between the frames.
So, as you saw, what the work does is primarily link the figure of the detective with that of the reader, and the figure of the writer with that of the criminal. The two narrative paths that only occasionally intersect are basically the written aspect of it is a more theoretical understanding of the difference between the classic English detective novel and the updated version, American version of it. And then the series of descriptions of or settings or ambiances that is read by this voiceover that is Lawrence Weiner. And I wanted to, I thought it would be interesting to have Lawrence read to us, like somehow altering his work, but also thinking about what the what the role of voiceover is, you know, like this omniscient, like this narrator that knows everything. And so it's a kind of like an homage in a way. And while working on this piece, that has, as I said, like very much to do with reading and deciphering and enigma, I developed the script for Methodology, which is a video that deals with writing and secrecy. The video actually takes up secrecy as a narrative structure and a mode of address, what is said and what cannot be said, the way people act in relation to what is alluded to, taken for granted, or ultimately silenced. And how, unlike the enigma that has only one correct solution, secrecy, or the possibility of constructing narrative built around a secret, destabilizes the story told in such a way that it becomes impossible to fully ever apprehend it. And before screening Methodology, I'd like to show a related work titled The Gift and the Retribution, which is a diptych consisting of photographs of the covers of these two books with cross dedications. As you've noticed, the dedication is a device through which authors somehow publicly justify their production, as well as the connection and dialogues between works of art and books is a recurring motif. These are the first editions of these two books, and this was important for me because I wanted to allude to the experience of what receiving such a gift would feel like, or what the initial experience of reading a book that was dedicated to you would feel like. This diptych, as Terry said, this diptych along with Methodology is what I'm showing at the Uruguayan Pavilion in Venice. So given the time, maybe I'll just screen Methodology, which is about 7 minutes, and then we can have questions and comments.
Suspensión de la incredulidad. Había una vez dos pececitos de la mano, y cuando se acordaron que no tenían manos, se soltaron.
Vos mencionabas mi constante dependencia con otros artistas.
Qué interesante estar por ahí. ¿A quiénes incluirías?
Y en ese entonces, a nosotros tres.
Para mí hay un juego alrededor del secreto como cuestión social que
que me parece una forma interesante de pensar la historia. Lo que se dice, lo que se puede decir, lo que se puede hacer. El modo en que los sujetos se desplazan en relación a lo que se da por aludido, lo que puede no ser dicho.
Me interesaba justamente preguntarme si la historia de ellos se construía a partir de lo no dicho, el sobreentendido, la ilusión.
Sí, me acuerdo que vos leías Sonetti en esa línea. Me acuerdo que vos decías que Sonetti no se trata de enigmas, sino de secretos que actúan en los textos y que son esos secretos los que definen las relaciones entre los personajes. Algo se sustrae de la historia, alguien sustrae algo, como las dos cartas que definen el relato en los adioses y que el narrador esconde en un cajón. No se trata de un elemento ambiguo que el crítico intenta descifrar o que en última instancia podría terminar atribuyendo al funcionamiento mismo de la literatura, sino que el relato se construye precisamente sobre un punto ciego a partir del cual es muy difícil estabilizar la lectura.
El cuento se construye justamente para hacer aparecer artificialmente algo que estaba oculto.
De todo lo dicho, uno siempre puede preguntar por qué.
Y otra vez, su conversación sobre el amor se vuelve una conversación sobre el escribir.
Por otro lado, en esa puesta en escena tan artificial, tan programada, es absolutamente preciso que el ocultar se vea. En el sentido de, sepan que estoy ocultándoles algo. Es decir, es preciso que se sepa que eso es algo que no quiero mostrar. Las sirenas, y esto ya lo sabemos a partir de aquel cuento de Kafka, en verdad estaban mudas y más hermosas que nunca. Las sirenas no querían seducirlo, sino tan solo interceptar su mirada, fascinarlo.
El miedo a envejecer nace del reconocimiento de que uno no está viviendo la vida que desea. Es un miedo equivalente a la sensación de estar utilizando mal el presente.
Aunque la historia estaba dedicada a otra persona, pensé que la habías escrito para mí.
Sabes, a mí esa carta que escribiste para la muestra me pareció antigua, vaga y específica, anónima, pero personal, llena de cosas que yo ya había escuchado o había dicho o quise decir. La carta me hizo acordar a gente que ya conocía. Yo tuve ganas de que esa carta hubiera sido escrita para mí.
Pero vos ya tenés cartas que yo te escribí directamente. ¿No son esas más importantes que la carta en exhibición?
El lenguaje es siempre un estado de exhibición. Mis cartas, o mejor dicho, tus cartas, me parecen limitadas. Están contenidas por los límites de nuestra relación. Esas cartas tienen la presencia y la autoridad de una tercera persona. Son testigos y a la vez emisarios o jueces de una cierta carga erótica o de una cierta necesidad de significar el deseo.
Lo La carta es una figura que marca la distancia y por lo tanto el deseo que existe entre dos personas. Incluso hay quienes dicen que las cartas se escriben precisamente para mantener al otro a distancia.
Encontrarse con eso tan íntimo en un lugar público fue extraño. Fue como que alguien te contara un secreto. Me parece como que de alguna manera me gané la confianza de un desconocido. Vos a mí me escribiste esas cartas porque ya tenías mi confianza. Esa es la diferencia.
Una de las aspiraciones era convertirse en inédito, borrar sus huellas, ser leído como se lee a un desconocido. Al principio había pensado publicar el texto como un libro anónimo, después pensó que debía publicarse con el nombre de algún escritor conocido, atribuir su libro a otro, el plagio al revés. Ser leído como si uno fuera ese otro escritor.
Thank you very much. So if there's any questions or comments, I'm happy to hear them.
Talking about the film with your grandfather that you showed us the stills of, and talk about the fact that the actual film is he's not speaking, it's his voiceover. Can you talk about that decision of?
Throughout the film, there's this. It's never clear whether it's his voice, or it's something he's reading, or something he's writing. Both of these activities are documented in the film. We see him writing and reading. But the words are not his, they're my words. And even though I discussed the script with him quite thoroughly, I didn't want it to seem like he was saying these words. This is the... The film addresses testimony from a very theoretical perspective, and he doesn't think nor think he doesn't use that language nor think in those terms. I was interested in this idea of how his experience of the Holocaust has to clash against his language capacity and the construction of social memory, and how his experience gets somehow reduced to the retelling of one same memory, and how that memory in itself constructs his own memory, and how it plays off each other. I don't know if I answered the question fully, but I could also screen the film. It's his voice, yes. Yeah. He is reading it. But as I said, I was interested in this play of, or this passage between witnessing and becoming an actor. Yes?
I'm curious about your thoughts in general on the digitization of books now on e-readers and online, and if you feel like that medium will affect or does affect the message and the literature that's coming through?
The answer is, I think it does affect, but I think implicit in the question is like a value judgment, and I tend to stay away from that because I think there's nothing inherently bad with new technology. And I don't believe in this either or situation. It's like when the LP came out and people thought that live performances were over type of thing. I don't know. But the question, the answer is yes. I think it does change a lot to read from an e-book or an e-reader than from actual printed matter. And also just in terms of design, e-books are not yet fully there. They're quite awful, actually. Please.
You focus on how we read, how the reader and the author interact, the activity of reading.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering, because I couldn't quite figure it out, what you're saying about looking. How are we looking? How are we seeing? Uh-huh. How are you collapsing both the language of the reader or reading with seeing and looking? That wasn't very clear.
I always think about that, like what the difference is between reading and looking, and if there is a difference. I think reading is primarily a visual act, and I think it's kind of a long question. It could take us a while to untangle that, but to summarize it, I think it has to do with what I was saying at the very beginning of this idea of slowing down and almost demanding of the viewer to slow down and to look at things again in some ways. And that's why, in a way, and I think the question links to the previous one in the sense that there's unwilling nostalgia about the work, like this old technology or old culture of the book. In the back.
This concerns your work that recollects the act of sending flowers to women artists that had influenced you. Uh-huh. There are a couple of questions. One is, what meaning should you attach to the fact that they're all women?
Uh-huh.
And number two, was there some response? And if so, is there some way of including that in the work?
Uh-huh. The work had a lot to do with initiating a dialogue with people I was interested in, and some of them I was already friends with, but most of them, or 7 out of 10, responded and either wrote back or emailed or called. So in a way, the project was a success. I was also, I think there's a little bit of a perversity in the project in the sense that there's like an instance of, it's kind of sad when you realize that you weren't the only one that were sent the flowers to. Like, usually this romantic gesture of sending flowers is done to one recipient. When you encounter that there's 9 others, it's kind of... So, and I don't really know how to answer the fact that they were all women. They were... I don't know. I guess I wanted to have it be a romantic... linked to a romantic... gesture, and I'm attracted to women, and I don't think that we always have to be so politically correct. I think that can sometimes get in the way. Sorry.
I was curious if you could talk a bit more about, in a couple of your images, there were 2-screen video format.
Yeah.
And why you decided to do that? Does it relate to your 2 narrative paths that you mentioned? Or even to like the open book format?
Yeah. Actually, it's a bit misleading because Everness, which I showed stills of the 2 portraits in black and white, that's a single channel. But India Song is, in fact, presented as an open book, and I was interested in these acts of repetition that occurred within her own film, but also with this idea of how, just how to bring to the forefront of the project its own methodology, and how by repeating the what is seen from different angles is mimicking what happens in the voiceover, which repeats what happens in the story, and so on and so forth. So I think, yeah, it has to do with repetition, or trying to illustrate this idea of repetition.
Basic question.
Those are always the most difficult, but yeah, go ahead.
It is a little difficult. I had this conversation with some students today, reading a Walter Benjamin text, and Benjamin was something that came up a few times.
Yeah.
And it was really clear that there was sort of a need on their part, maybe perceived or not, that they needed a kind of prior knowledge to sort of enter into a text that otherwise seemed somewhat nonsensical. Mm-hmm. So I wonder if how you think about the prior knowledge of the audience in relationship to your work.
Yeah. It is kind of a difficult question. I think the idea of the work is to allow different points of entry, and there's different like hooks or seduction instances, be it beauty, humor, and other strategies that somehow trap you and then take you somewhere else, hopefully. It's hard for me to gauge how much knowledge is required, because I produce it knowing that, having that information. So I don't know, hopefully it doesn't leave people out. And I often play with this idea of like immediately after the Margarita Duras's India Song project, I did a video with Felix Barto Hernandez, which is a Uruguayan author that is not known or practically unknown. So playing with this like idea of when you recognize the source text and when you don't, and how that creates like different forms of appropriation, almost limiting on piracy, or yeah. So yeah, it's something I think about, but I don't have a clear answer, unfortunately. In the back.
How much were you influenced by Godard? And that last film seemed like
a lot.
Filming a conversation.
Yeah. Godard is very influential to me. The way he uses references and the way he constructs a narrative, I learned a lot from that. I think my first background is just watching films. That's really how I learned. Any other questions?
You're fine. I'm just like, it's kind of like a basic but silly question at the same time. On your piece of Here Comes the Sun, and with all like the When I'm Happy, I won't have to do this anymore, I kind of got confused on like, what's your viewpoint on hope?
On hope? No, it's a good question. I'm trying to be very optimistic. Any other questions? Yes?
In your work dealing with observed conversations, more so in the principal and in this last film, how conscious are the participants of the future publication?
No. Sorry if I was misleading, but they agree to produce a book. It's... and they're free to determine how that conversation is had, be it live and recorded and later transcribed, or via email. I'm not really interested in measuring or quantifying people's rhetoric capacity. I'm happy to edit as much as they want. And the idea was actually that after a number was published, we would start again and somehow talk about, like, okay, I did this book 5 years ago, but now I think completely different. I want to revisit that and not have the printed word be like the definitive thing. Yeah, but they fully agree to produce a book. It's not something I, maybe because I said it was for me a way of eavesdropping on art history, so that was maybe confusing, but it was a metaphor.
So has that happened? Has it come 5 years? Is it time for a revenge?
Not yet. I mean, it will be 5 years, but I still think it's almost like a gallery program. Like, I still want more until people have a second chance. Yeah.
I was just curious if you saw any distinction between the work that you produced, though at least some of the stuff that was text-based, in the video at the end. Sort of using English versus Spanish in your work?
I think at this point I'm practically bilingual. I don't think in Spanish and then translate, and I'm living in New York, so why should I make a point of making work in Spanish? In the case of the videos, the actors are Spanish speakers, and I... working in film is also a way of creating like this economy around the work and employing people and working with a crew and so on and so forth. And I was interested in working with film students in either Uruguay or Argentina and employing this particular actor that I feel very comfortable with and that he reappears in films. And yeah, but I don't know.
Well, can I ask a follow-up question?
Sure.
Well, in that case, how do you think it affects your audience? Some who may be like understanding the work in Spanish and others in English, who are sort of reading it in one language or the other.
I don't know. That's how I saw film. Like, all of foreign films came translated, and that's my experience of. And I try to keep as literal of a translation as possible. I don't do like Omar Fass tricks where the voice is saying one thing and the written text is going somewhere else. In these cases, it's just functional. Any other questions? Okay, thank you very much.